Okay, there we go. All right. So, and this is, originally, by the way, that when I first read this, when I first read Sefer Orot, there was, I used this, this is the original copy of what it came out many years ago. It was put out by a publisher called Jason Aronson, and it was only available in English. And the I think the key is that Magid books, which is really an offshoot of Koren, came out and was actually able to reprint it. This is out of print. This was out of print for many years. It was very nice. It was a readable print itself, not the very nicest print, but it did not have the Hebrew. No one had the Hebrew with it. So if you wanted to read it and were to read the Hebrew as well, you were forced to kind of use the standard version of Orot. This was the Orot that's in Hebrew, and trying to match them together. And what Koren decided to do is they went back, and they, first of all, after a number of years, because this was actually published, I don't remember when, a long time ago, probably 30, 40, 50 years ago, this was published here in 1993, and this was published as the new version that Koren put out, which, by the way, includes not just a new introduction, was published in 2014, so there's about a 20-year span between the two editions, but also the footnotes were updated. He added more footnotes. He added other things as well that were not in that first edition. So Bezalel and Naor actually took advantage of the 2 decades between the first edition, 93, and the second edition in 2014, to be able to kind of update some of the things. Didn't change away the text, but included the notes and made the notes more readable themselves. Here's what you have to know about Sefer Orot. Rav Kook is a very... You've learned a lot of Rav Kook, and Rav Kook himself was a very poetic writer. So reading the English is helping us understand the Hebrew, because the Hebrew is very hard to kind of get through. On the other hand, reading the English without the Hebrew is missing some of the meaning of Rav Kook. So what I'm going to try to do is I have to decide whether I want to do the English, and then look at the Hebrew, and then the English. It is slow reading. If you read it too much, too quickly, you just kind of you lose the whole thing. That's number one. Second of all, you need to know the time framework of when this actually was put out together. That's what I want to put up here in the moment. Okay, this should be, here we go. This is the front page of the Sefer. If you don't have it, I didn't send it out overnight. This is what the sharp light, the front page looks like. This is, and it's called the original 1920 version. Anybody know why the original 1920 version? Because over the course of time, different pieces were added to Sefer Orot. So the original 1920 version had 4 basic pieces in the book. And over the course of time, in Rav Kook's lifetime, and even after he passed away, other pieces were added to it. So by the time you get to the 1950 or so edition, or 59 edition, you probably have a book that's twice the size, which were added from different writings of Rav Kook that are there. But that's why he calls it the original 1920 version. This is obviously just from the English edition. And this is, I'm not going to go through this piece here, this is just a translation, this is the introduction, but here's what I want to show you. There are actually really 4 basic pieces on the Sefer Orot, okay? And they actually were written, believe it or not, in different time periods. The original Sefer that Rav Kook wrote was this piece part, which is really the fourth part, Orot Atchia, Lights of Renaissance, Lights of Reliving, which is the longest piece in the book itself. The subsections are actually they're probably longer than the other parts themselves. It runs, I forget how many sections there are, about 70 sections or so, 70 subsections. It was written actually in the early 19-teens, so it's written somewhere probably about 1914, and it was pretty much ready to go to press. And unfortunately, what happened, you talk about modern events taking place and history repeating itself, World War I broke out. And as a result, it couldn't go to press. Things just, everything kind of came to a crashing halt. So the book itself remained in a manuscript, was finished in this Orot Atchia. Orot Atchia is really what will be when we have an Eretz Yisrael, what's going to be. There's a lot of theology here of Rav Kook that's going on. During World War One, I said World War Two. During World War One, from 1914 until when it was over, 1917, 18, I don't remember anymore, Rav Kook actually had the misfortune or fortune of being outside of Israel. He traveled. He was traveling on a mission to begin raise. I think he was trying to raise money for his ideals and his institutions. He was the rabbi of Yafo at that point. He was not the chief rabbi of Palestine, I don't believe, at that point. And he was stuck outside of Israel. He couldn't get back in. He ended up spending 2 years in Switzerland, And I think he may have gone for after that to England. I can't remember. It's all in the introduction before the war ended, and then he was able to come back in. So this whole piece itself is written here. Let's say it was ready to go to press in 1914, and couldn't go, and it ended up going to press in 1920. So after the war was over. Now the other part is, who actually puts together the books of Rav Kook? So Rav Kook is a great writer. Rav Kook does. The problem of Rav Kook is, besides the languages, he's not a writer that has part A leads to part B, to part C, to part D, to part E, part 1, part 2. Like you read a novel, or you read any kind of thesis, there's chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5. Rav Kook writes in bursts of mystical and creative energy. But each burst is really almost like a standalone burst. There are different subtitles, subjects, but each piece itself is going to be a separate standalone piece. So, for example, if I told you that there are 62, I forgot how many pieces there are in Oros HaTchiyah, there are, I'll tell you exactly how many pieces there are. There's going to be here, going to be 70, no, I'm sorry, 72, 72, 72 subsections in this, in Oros HaTchiyah. So there are a few sections go together naturally, but in many cases they're different. You go from one section, one subsection to the next subsection. It's a related theme, and they're put in order. They're ordered by his son. He doesn't write them. He really writes them separately. It's really like he kept these notebooks, and he kept his writings, and he kept his pieces. But it's not like he wrote the whole thing together. Over the course of time, you've got 72 different pieces, and you have different pieces that are put together. Who puts them together? His son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Kook. So this is written by Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook. That's the Rav Kook. His son is the one who's really in charge of, I don't want to say editing, but organizing his material. Rav Kook was a funny thing to say. He's a creative soul, a creative writer, but he was not well organized, not very good at organizing it. So he'd have all these 72 different pieces, and they just went and rambled around from topic to topic. So his son came along and organized them, and that's what was ready to go right before the war. Was this piece called Orot HaTchiyah, which his son had organized, and I believe it was pretty much ready to go. I don't know if it was fully ready, but it was about ready to go. And then, of course, the war
Sorry,
came.
Rabbi.
Yeah?
I don't know if this is true, but I heard, maybe I read it, that his son was to the right of Rav Kook, and he may have added in some of his own stuff to kind of put it in there, and really it's not Rav Kook's.
Well, there are definitely some changes that happened on later editions. That's why it's important to know this is the 1920 edition. Okay, in other words, you're right. He may have been a little bit more to the right of Rav Kook. I don't think he really changed a whole lot of what Rav Kook. There may have been some words that he moved around, but surely a lot less in the 1920 edition than happens in later editions. That's why it's important to know when it says 1920 edition, what does this mean? Does it mean it's like the century that went by, 1920 to 2020? No, it means this is the original book as it was written. And Bitzalel Na'or is really good in the footnotes to explain to you if he thinks that changes happen in different editions or other writings or of Kook. He actually goes back and points it out. The notes are copious. The notes are copious. In fact, the piece that I sent out to you, I tried to put the footnotes in the back of that on the piece that I actually copied you. We can't do all the footnotes, but if you go through the footnotes, you'll see how carefully Bitzalel Na'or really went through it. Now, what I just want to say one more thing. So first thing you need, so before we get our feet into this. The first thing is, I told you once again, this piece over here that begins on page 179, what is called Oros HaTchiyah. That's really like the fourth piece of the book, and I'll tell you what the first three are in a moment, was the one that was written really before World War I. This is Rav Kook's theology, ideology of what he believed in, what the new country is going to be like, the new country, state, whatever it will be, is really how it's going to be founded on. Now, on the course of the next 4 years or so, 4 or 5 years, especially when Rav Kook is away and he's outside of Eretz Yisrael, so he also writes, he continues writing. He doesn't stop writing. So Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Kook, who then comes back in 1920 to finally can publish it, he can finish off. I guess he couldn't get the galleys to his father to approve them. There was to, you know, this is 1915, 16. People weren't traveling back and forth. He couldn't get back in, and communication was not what it is. You can't just simply fax or Xerox or scan in a galley to send to someone overnight or in a few minutes. So what happened by 1920 Now, Tzvi Yehuda decided to include into the Sefer actually three other pieces that Rav Kook wrote, that he organized. They're much shorter, and they kind of were called Orot Me'ofel. Orot Me'ofel, the words Orot Me'ofel means lights from darkness. They're almost like precursors to actually building the land of Israel. What's going to happen? So really, historically, in terms of the chronology, this piece was written earlier than these pieces. Am I making sense? This is written somewhere, this is finished right at the beginning of World War I, or towards the beginning of World War I. These pieces are written during the first, especially the first 2 years of World War I, when Rav Kook is outside the land of Israel, frustrated that he can't get back into the land. Can you imagine Rav Kook, the protagonist who looks for the land of Israel, the state of Israel, he's stuck, and there's no way to get back in. You know how frustrated you get if you ever get your flight is canceled and you have to stay overnight in a place and then you snowed out or what happened, rain or some other weather issue came up or the flight got canceled and you scratch your head, what am I going to do? This is not one night. This is 2, 3, 4 years he can't get back in. So once again, he continues.
I think we've experienced that frustration even now, not being able to get there for 2 years.
There you go. I'm telling you, there's so much that's relevant to what we're doing now. I mean, like, you know, you're living this again. But you're not Rav Kook. And the fact that you can't get to the United States of America, or you can't get to the land of Israel, the state of Israel, you actually could if you really jumped hoops. He couldn't even get in jumping hoops. There were no boats. No one was traveling. You're afraid of the U-boats. Afraid they're going to get drowned and blown out of the water, so to speak. So there was no way to get back in, and I don't know, he couldn't get back into Israel because of all the different antagonisms and fighting going on during World War I. World War I is a terrible thing. And guys, we're almost on the eve of World War III. Chalila v'chalila, it shouldn't be, but things are going in crazy ways. The bottom line was, these three pieces, I'll call them three pieces, they're from the one subsection, the one title called Orot Me'ofel. There's one piece about Eretz Yisrael, one piece about the Milchama. The Milchama he's writing about is really obviously the First World War. But for that matter, and you'll see when we get to it, it could be any war. It could be the present war going on in Ukraine. What he basically says, first, this piece talks about the importance of Israel, how to be a real Jew, you got to live in the land of Israel. HaMilchama is telling us that the difficulties coming about in the war are really from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give opportunities, because when you take all your marbles and throw them up in the air, and all the marbles come down, they don't look the same way as when you pick them off the ground. They all bounce in different ways. And the Milchama, which changed the world, this says not only was it wasn't only the last war, so to speak, it wasn't the great war, this wasn't the Remembrance Day, the 11th hour, the 11th month, the 11th, whatever it was. It was really, more importantly, understanding that nationhood could actually now be developed. All the nations, all the groups that were pushing for their national resurgence of who they were, their identity, were pushing and came to the fore after World War I was over and there was no more Ottoman Turkish Empire and the whole landscape, the whole geography changed completely. And different countries were able to pop up and start. The Jewish people had that opportunity too. That's why the Milchama becomes important. Except that for us, it wasn't just about territory. It wasn't just about national identity. It was something more basic to who we are. And then, so this is actually about eight subsections. This is 10 subsections. And then Yisrael L'Tchiaso, Yisrael and its Renaissance is really the transition between this piece and between Orot HaTchia. So the Israel coming back to life is taking place after, as part of this piece. So Orot Me'ofel is called lights from darkness. Orot HaTchia means lights of renewal. Now, there's a big difference. This is like the preparation. So the whole, you need to get the prep behind it to begin to understand the part of Rav Kook that's Orot HaTchia. So when his son put it together, when his son actually published this book in 1920, he took these three pieces here and put them in, even though they were written historically after Orot HaTchia was written. Am I making sense? In other words, this piece was written before 1914, or just about the night, and these pieces were written from 1914 to about 1916, 17, 18 or so. But the organization makes sense. They were organized. That's why I said the key is, and it's not so much the Rav Tzvi Yehuda that changed things. He was a great organizer. He was able to go through all of his father's material and put them together in different topics. Whereas he didn't have a mishmash. He just had different sundry pieces. Can you imagine writing different? I don't know. Making different notations over different days and writing things. Then you suddenly look a year later and say, what was I thinking when I wrote this? And that's what needed someone to go put it together to make sure it happened and make sure it was all together as well. So there are a couple of things here. Once again, we've done Rav Kook in the past. When we did with Rav Weinberger, we had the advantage or the yeah, the help of Rav Weinberger's writings and understandings of what's being said here, what he was saying. We're not going to have that when we go into Sefer Orot. We're really on our own. There are some svarim that are written about it that we can use them to summarize and help us understand it. But we're really going to have to go through it ourselves. But it's doable, it's readable. The further you go, by the way, the further you go into it, the more complex actually it becomes. Those, the pieces here in Orot HaTchiya are more complex in nature in theology than they are the first three pieces. So it's a really good way that Ratzvi Yehuda, the son, set up the actual Sefer itself. One thing I will say, we are all sitting around this table except for Tony Simcover, and I don't see him today. We are all diaspora Jews. Okay, let's call a spade a spade. We all have aspirations to go to Israel, and some of us hopefully will one day. But the vial in the interim, we are really living outside of Israel. The key to Rav Kook is going to be, and it's a very hard pill for a diaspora Jew to swallow. I think we can make it. I don't think anyone's going to choke, but we're going to come close to need to get aspirated, perhaps at certain times. As Rav Kook says, basically, if you're not living in Israel, something very basic is missing. Okay? Something very basic. You can't do outside of Israel what you can do in Israel. And if you think that you can, then you're really missing, you miss the boat, not just miss the boat, you miss the key of what Judaism is. Everything changes, everything is different in the land of Israel from being outside the land of Israel. It's kind of like saying that watching the game at ringside, right, at field level, is much different than sitting up in the 600 bleachers. If you're up in the 600 bleachers, you're going to be part of the game. You're not sitting and watching it on ESPN. You're there. And you, but you know what? The people that you're looking down on the ground look like little ants. When you're sitting at game field, at field level, you're kind of really part of it. Everybody can understand what that is, even if, you know, you never sat at game level. But you understand what I'm talking about. In other words, and that's really what Rav Kook is going to say about Judaism. The Judaism of living in Israel, or building the land of Israel and developing the land of Israel, is a much more charged spiritual thing. Now, you say, well, I don't feel that. I feel like I'm a good spiritual Jew. I feel I'm a good spiritual Jew. And Rav Kook would probably say, Yeris, you probably feel that way, but you know what? You don't really understand what you're missing. You don't know what you're missing.
Rabbi, I don't know if that's such a radical point. Is that a radical point, Rav Kook? Because we all feel that way. The Torah,
yeah,
and the Torah, everybody says that.
I agree. I believe that's a truism.
Okay.
It's a trite comment because...
Good. Then you'll have no problem doing the book. Then you won't have any problem when we do the book.
No, I'm saying, is there any other view? In other words, who would argue with that?
Who would argue with that? I'll tell you who would argue with that. Satmar would argue with that.
That's fringe.
Okay, well, the Satmar, they're not fringe. Well, you know what? Most North American, most diaspora Jews would say that Israel is really important. It's the center of the faith. But if I go to Israel a couple of times in the year and I go, you know, I daven at the Kotel or I go to other places or I just wander the streets and itself, I still realize that Israel is important. And of course, every day I say, you know, we'll come back with design, we'll be there. We're coming. Rav Kook says, buddy, you don't understand. If you're not there now, if you're not there, you only got a pale shadow of what you think it is. Now, do you want to live in a pale shadow, or do you want to live in the real McCoy? Do you want to sit at the 200 level? You want to sit in the boxes? You want to sit at the field level, rink level? You want to sit in the 600 level of the bleachers? Where do you want to sit? That's what I'm saying. Everybody who sits up in the 600 level says, you know what? Oh, I wish I had the money to buy a box. I wish I could get a season holder's box, the box level. I wish I could sit in on field level. But you know what? I don't. I know it's important, but I don't have it. I don't have the money. So I'm going to get away with sitting up in the 600 level. I get a bit of no, watching people down there and then watching the field itself. But I'm on the 600.
But we know this. And the reality is, and the reason why none of us are there is because we're not pushed there yet. It's not that strong enough. We're not willing to sacrifice to move there. None of us. Okay. Right. Fine.
Okay.
It's not always about sacrificing to move there, the comforts of North America. Sometimes you just have obligations.
Okay,
Shelley, that's the point. Why wouldn't you move there? Because you're not willing to sacrifice your obligations here. Like, let's call it what it is, right? Me,
okay.
You're welcome.
I'm not, this is not a guilt trip. This is not meant to create guilt.
After God willing, we're going on Sunday, but not to live.
Okay. So
we believe that more. Okay. We believe that we're willing to sacrifice.
So
we're not.
Right? This is not about trying to make people feel bad or feel good. I just want you to know, I want you to just appreciate, this is what made Rav Kook so special about his connection to the land of Israel. It's not that he just, like, he was like intrinsically connected to it. Basically, he says, like, you got to appreciate, therefore, what it meant for him to be outside of Israel in World War I. He was plotting, he was dying. And Rafal said, I know we couldn't travel during the pandemic. The difficulties we had, or the pieces that were missing, couldn't go visit grandchildren and children and so forth and so on, and the Gansa Maisa, pales compared to Rav Kook. We'll see when you begin to read them. That's why I said you got to begin to read them before you read the introduction, because you got to really get your feet into what this is all about. So that's what I'm trying to say is you need to understand that this is really something very unique about how far Rav Kook really believes that Eretz Yisrael is not simply something external. It's not something, a way to kind of strengthen the nation. There's a difference. It's like the difference between playing, I don't know, by playing softball and playing in the major leagues. It's not the difference between playing in the major leagues and playing in AAA. Forgive the analogies to baseball. It's not the difference between being in the championships or the World Series and not getting in. It's the difference, according to Rav Kook, between playing Major League and between playing softball when you play with your kids. Okay, it's the same game, but you know what? There's a whole lot of difference. And the Hanah, the enjoyment or the experience is a different type of experience. Just want to put this down before we actually jump into this. But that is why... You may remember when Rob Weinberger talked about he spoke to us, and he talked about the fact that, you know, not many people study Rav Kook outside the land of Israel. It's because of the reason that Rav Kook is really stressed is the importance of being in Israel. I'm just letting you guys know what you're getting into. That's all. I think we'll do it. Don't worry. We're not going to have to use the paddles to get people back up. Okay. I'm not in Israel. I'm gone. Okay. Forgive me. So that's the piece itself.
Can I ask something? The Light of Renaissance was written before Israel and its Renaissance, but he wrote Israel and its Renaissance when he was outside of Israel.
Yes. Yes, he did. Yes.
So that's a review of the Light of Renaissance.
Yeah, well, he's talking about the importance of Israel. So I'm saying you need to understand, he wrote these pieces. These pieces,
I know.
Yes? I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
There's a Light of Renaissance that was written before Israel and its Renaissance.
Yeah, okay,
analyzing what life is like, what life should be like when he's outside of Israel.
Right. Well, he was in Israel. He was in Israel.
Yeah, I know.
He was in Israel, now he's stuck outside land. He's actually writing what life should be like when he gets back there. He's hoping to get back. He's hoping any day. He was stuck for years. He was stuck for much longer than he was kind of happy to be stuck out of Israel. By the way, Rabbi Avram is actually pointing out something. You just have to follow through, make sure you don't confuse the names. This is called Yisrael Tchiyato. This is called Orot HaTchiyah. Both have Tchiyah, which B'tzal HaNa'or translates as Renaissance. Tchiyah sometimes can be translated as rebirth. So this is called Israel and its Renaissance, which is from the first part of Orot Me'ofel. This is called Orot HaTchiyah, the lights of Renaissance. It's confusing a little bit because you got Renaissance, Renaissance, Renaissance. I'm not sure why it chose that name. That's the name. I can't change it. Yisrael, its Renaissance, and Orot HaTchiyah. But almost, that's why I say this piece is really like this piece here is like a transition between the first part towards the second part itself. Just understand how the book itself is set up. Okay, now let's begin today. Let's begin the stuff itself. It's almost ironic that we're doing this when things are going crazy in Ukraine and we have, I don't know, it looks like Gog and Magog, by the way, going on there. I can't understand nobody understands what's going on.
And it's interesting that you say that, because in his introduction he refers to that with World War One using
Yes. And it's even more interesting because actually people don't know. People think Gog and Magog is Gog and Magog. It's not really true. If you look in the Navi talks about Gog from the land of Magog. There's one villain.
Gog is the leader.
Gog is the leader. Gog is the villain. Gog is the Putin. Gog is whoever you want to make him to be, whatever it is. But it's not like a. It's not like, you know, bad guy against someone else. It's not like various people. There's one bad guy called Gog, who comes from the land of Magog. Okay, like Putin from Moscow or something like that. I don't mean necessarily to say that's the same thing, but he does talk about them. Anyways. That's really just my way of trying to get into this. And let's see, let me close up the pieces from Talmud here. I don't need this. Okay, so here, this is now here. So what I did was, I tried to send you guys both the Hebrew and the English together. Okay, the trick is trying to get both of them on the same page itself. That's a little more trickier than I thought. What I'm actually going to begin with, and I guess I probably should have shown you this before we do this, is there's also Rav Tzvi Yehuda put it together as well. At the very end is a great call, which goes back to 1908. This is the very end of the Sefer. It'll take us a long time to get there. But more importantly, he puts in as an introduction to what the Sefer is, something called Degel Yerushalayim. I need to explain to you what Degel Yerushalayim actually is. Degel Yerushalayim is the banner of Jerusalem. This is almost like making a political religious movement that was Rav Kook's idea that is as Zionistic as Bnei Akiva and as right-wing religious as the Aguda. Does those phrases resonate with people? So Rav Kook wanted to create his own movement, his own youth movement, his own political movement.
All right, Rabbi, did they actually have that in Israel? Say the Chazal.
Yes, they do. Correct.
Is Bnei Akiva with
on steroids? Yes, correct. Okay, they actually have in Israel. They have Bnei Akiva, then they have Ezra. There's a number of youth movements, but political movements don't really happen today.
Raphael. You consider yourself
right-wing? That was a question you were filed. How are you going to handle that?
I'm Volgoda Aguda. That's why I asked
you. Okay. So everybody considers them. You know what? We're all in the center. Wherever you are, you're the center of the world. But this Degel Yerushalayim, Rav Kook actually did not want to align himself with Mizrahi, fascinatingly enough. Because he actually was concerned with some of the issues of Mizrahi. He didn't feel it actually was, I guess, I don't want to say religious, right-wing enough with it. So he actually wanted to make his own movement. By the way, the movement died. The movement never took off. Okay. The other thing that Rav Kook is going to write in this piece, but it's a good introduction to begin to understand what the ideology of Rav Kook is. So Rav Tzvi Yehuda, when he published this, when he published the book, he included this as well in the introduction as the first piece. And it really sets the stage itself for what there is. Rav Kook actually is—it's really Rav Kook's Rav Kook stuff. But he used the term Yerushalayim to refer to the religious element of Israel, and he refers to Zionism as the secular element. Okay, he didn't know that. We're talking about Rav Kook as like the protagonist for Zionism. When you're seeing this in this paragraph, we're going to start it right now. Degel Yerushalayim. He specifically uses Yerushalayim. In his mind, Yerushalayim is the religious ideal, the religious spiritual center of the Jewish people. Not the political center of Solomon, not the political center of the kings of Judea, the religious center of everything in Judaism. We talk about Yerushalayim. Now, people wanted to go back to Israel to kind of build a secular state, but they're missing the Yerushalayim. They have the Zion part of the state. They have Zion, Zion. Now, the truth is, it's a play on words. Zion is Jerusalem. Zion, when you talk about Zion itself, Zion actually referred probably to Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount. When we talk about Zionism, we don't mean Zionism, we talk about the whole land of Israel. I'm a Zionistic Jew, or I'm a religious Zionist. I believe in Israel. But Zion, Zion itself, the word Zion actually means marker, but Zion actually really refers to Jerusalem, except the name itself is going to be indicative of what this is. So, this is the way we're going to get into it itself. And we're just going to jump into it right here, over here. Just by the way, I did not copy the intro. There's a preface written by Rav Yehuda Kook. I'll just read you very quickly that he writes here, and it's a page before Degel Yerushalayim. You're listen to it for a moment. It's two paragraphs. Out of the holy writings of our teacher, my father, the Rav, they call him the Rav, may he live long, good years, Amen, whose publication was delayed due to the war and are due to appear shortly with the help of God, I've taken these lights of Renaissance, which illuminate by their words the values and spirit and action of the process of building the house of Israel through its Renaissance and return to its Holy Land. Forgive me for zipping through this. It says, I have taken these chapters, which basically are lights of Renaissance. They are Orot HaTchiyah, they're lights, spiritual lights of rebirth, which through the words that you're going to read soon, we're not going to read them soon, but I'm about to kind of take it to press. It's going to be published soon. He's writing this as he's before he takes it to the printers. So he says, will be published soon. You would think that normally he would write it, it's being published. He's got all these galleys. He's writing an introduction. I'm calling it the part, the lights of Renaissance. And at the same time, there's a second paragraph from Svi Yehuda. At the same time, I've seen fit to precede these chapters written approximately 2 years before the war with the chapters of Lights from Darkness, Orot Me'ofel, which is subdivided into three parts, the Land of Israel, the War, Israel and its Renaissance. The latter were written during the first 2 years of the war, which our teacher, my father, the Rav, may live very good years, spent in Switzerland. So he's just telling you that he put together two different pieces. The first piece is really later than the last, the fourth piece itself. But this is, then he puts here, Degel Yerushalayim, the banner of Yerushalayim. So what is Degel Yerushalayim? Okay, here we go, guys. Hold on to your seatbelts, okay? So, right. You have, you put it on, you okay? Avram is the only one with a seatbelt. There you go. Okay, well, okay, thank you. Okay, here we go. So I apologize. The first few pages of Degel Yerushalayim, it's a three pager, I think. I didn't have the setting properly on my scanner, so it's a little light. It's darker in the pages after the first three pages. Okay. So writes Rav Kook, we're speaking. This is once again. It's called Banner Yerushalayim, and it's in the subtitle is called Tchiyat Goy Kadosh Al Admat Kodesh. The Renaissance, Tchiyah means rebirth, the Renaissance of the Holy Nation upon the Holy Soil. That's what it's called. You have to remember, this is 1920. 1920, there is no land, there's no state of Israel. There's a land of Israel, right? There's Palestine is the name of the British-controlled area now, after World War I. I don't know what it was called before. What did the Ottoman Turks call it? I think also Palestine. And people called it Palestine, the non-Jews called it Palestine because they wanted to evoke the image of it being a land of the Philistines. Palestine and Philistine is the same root. They didn't want to talk about being the Jews. No one wanted to go to the Jews, really, except the Jews. Okay, we're speaking, writes Rav Kook here. Here we go. We're speaking of the soul of our national renaissance. Anu medabrim al dvar nishmat hatchiyah halomit shelanu. We're talking about the soul of our national renewal in this introduction, which is the root of life of the aspiration to build the land. What is it? Al-Dvar Shoresh Ha-Chayim Shal Shivat Binyan Aretz. We're looking forward to the root of life, the basis of life, the origins of life in our wish, in our Shifa to build land, because in 1920 very little was built. Arzeinu HaKadosha, our holy land. You hear Arzeinu HaKadosha, it sounds like very religious. That's, in those days, he's stressing that the land itself is holy. That's not a political statement. That's a statement about what the land is. Bidei Ha'am Ha'olech V'chayeh. Who's going to build this land? The people who are living and alive, Shu Tchiyat HaKodesh, which is going to be the rebirth and the renaissance of the holy. So the land is holy. Now I'm going to tell you how we're going to rebuild this holy land by the holy people. You can be a holy person if you're not religious necessarily, and the land can be holy even if it looks like it's not developed, like it's a big mess. But it's something special. Now, how do you define holiness? That's the hardest thing to do. Hardest thing is to really define in rational terms what holiness means, because holiness is not a rational term. Very difficult to explain it. I mean, we talk about it all the time. But can you give me a 25-word definition or a 5-word definition of holiness? It's holy. It's sacrosanct. We're using one word for another word. I can tell you what big means. Okay, I tell you what a big guy is. I can tell you what a tall guy is. A tall guy is someone taller than, I don't know, 5'8" or something. I can tell you what a short guy is. He's, you know, there's a short man shop, and someone under 5'4", 5'2", 5'0". I'm giving you feet and inches. But I can't really define what is holiness. How do I define what is more holiness, less holiness? But the land of Israel is soaked with holiness. It's not just soaked with mud and dirt. It's soaked with holiness in a different way. And who's going to build? Who's the only people who can build this land? People that are holy. People that are attuned to this idea. Now, Otsar HaChaim Shel HaKodesh, the treasure of light of the holy. Let me just get my pointer out. Make it easier for me to go through this here. Point the guy, come on down, there you go. So, Otsar HaChaim Shel HaKodesh, the treasure of life of the holy, is found where? Bechol Leib Yisrael Hu Ganus, is found stored in the heart of every heart of Israel. In other words, every person has got a bit of that holiness of the land of Israel. the holy in general, and the holiness that is needed for this found land of Israel, is found b'klalu shel ha'umah. It's found in the nation as a whole. The kikoach zehu arode b'chol ha'lichotam ha'ota. It is the power that controls all of its ways and arigasa l'mechtzava l'tchia l'arbza. It controls all the ways in its essence. In other words, everything we're trying to do is going to happen by our understanding the holiness that's within us. We take the holiness, and that controls who we are. Now, the nation's longing for its origin, its renaissance, its land, exists only in the quality of holiness that's peculiar to its character. So in other words, who is the one who can actually develop this? Who can develop this? Only the Jewish people. In other words, only we who really best understand what the land of Israel is all about. We have the sense of holiness. On the other hand, if you don't have the sense of holiness and you're not aware of it, you really can't build the land. The land requires it to be built with a sense of understanding of what's going on. You're going to be the machzava, the tchiyata, the arza, rak tchunat ha-kodesh ha-miuchad, le'ofya hi kayemet. The only thing that exists is this wish, this goal, so to speak, of holiness that is set aside for this, the aspirations to build the character itself. Ha-ofi shal tchunah ha-shel, tchiyat ha-chol, enenu kiyim, prozda shal ha-tratlin. The dimension of secular renaissance, he's obviously talking about, you know, what we would call modern Zionism. The fact that we have people who are building the land and going in to make it whole and build it up and take the swamps and make them usable and building kibbutzim and building settlements. This is a secular renaissance. This is really what he calls here Tchiyat HaChol, the renaissance of the mundane, of the secular. What's that? That's important, but it's not the finale. It's only a corridor before the banquet hall. It's a prozdor shel ha-tratlin. It's the entrance hall. It's a 600th level of the stands. You're upstairs, and I give you the example of 600th level being Chutz La'aretz. But he's trying to say, like, you know, you get into the stadium, you're outside, you're walking up the ramp, you're walking up to get to your seat. You're not in the stadium yet. You're standing outside, you're going through the security when you walk into the stadium. If you don't have the feeling of holiness within you in the land of Israel, you can only go so far. And if you, now you got to go, you have to begin somewhere, right? You've got to begin somewhere. But if you just talk about the secular renaissance, it's a corridor before the banquet hall, the first steps the child begins to walk. Hatzadim harishonim shavlad matchil alecha. The first kind of baby steps that a kid makes. You know how the kid starts and toddles and then falls over and gets up and walks again? Eventually, that beginning of the baby steps will lead to proper walking. Vasher hemiviu larutz orach gibor. Eventually, it's going to bring him to make run like a strong person, like a warrior, like a strong person. But you can't start until you learn to get on 2 feet. So the starting to build the land with the secular push that's happening started with Herzl, started before Herzl, started with people going to the land of Israel, first Aliyah, second Aliyah, Zionist Congress, and all this. This secular approach is really just the beginning. It's just the entrance way. Now, if you don't get into the entrance hall, the front hall, you can't get into the main hall. If you don't walk in the door, right? If you don't walk in the door, you can't get inside. You've walked in, you've gotten into the first outer door. You're in the cloakroom where you got to get, take your coat off. So that's a beginning, but it's not the end. Because to really get to the end, to really get to where you are, you've got to get into the main hall. That can only be done by someone who really understands the main hall, which is, of course, going to be the person who understands what the secular, what the holiness is all about. That's how this started. So he says, therefore, what I'm talking to you about in this opening piece about my society or my group called Dega Yushalayim is I want to make a group of people who will come together as a party, as a grouping, who understand Yushalayim, who understand the holiness that there is, because it doesn't exist now. Mizrahi is, he thinks Mizrahi is sold out maybe to the secular Zionists. The secular Zionists surely don't understand holiness. The Satmar and the religious right don't understand Israel at all. It's for them, it's a secondary kind of thing. So I got to make my own group. Yes, Semi. Is that Semi?
Yeah, I just want to know, because Chabad Zion was powerful. That wasn't Mizrahi, that was a predecessor, right?
There were other groups. He's not the only group, but he somehow he couldn't find himself in any of the groups that existed. Chovei Tzion was a much older group. Chovei Tzion really starts in the 1800s. They really was not a strong group in terms of having an impact upon history. They got people going initially. At this point, I'm not even sure Chovei Tzion still exists in 1920.
Okay.
You have Mizrahi, you have Pauli Mizrahi, you have Aguda, you have Pauli Aguda. You have probably other groups that kind of came and went. and you have his group. And unfortunately for Rav Kook, this vision that he has about Degi Yerushalayim never really takes off. It's one of the big failures of Rav Kook. I have to say failure. It was one of the unsuccesses. In fact, a lot of what Rav Kook believes in and writes about, when he died in 1935, none of this was taking place. This is before World War II. Can you imagine this? He's hoping to build a country. Things are going to settle down. We haven't even gotten to the Shoah yet. He couldn't even imagine in 1920. He was hoping we'll go to the land of Israel, we'll build the land of Israel, we'll have our own peace, everything will live happily ever after. Right? And of course, as we've pointed out, 100 years have happened, and have we gotten there? The answer is yes, we have gotten there. Sure, we've gotten there. We've haven't gotten there, we've gotten further. Okay, I keep coming back to this. In my mind, my mind is just blown away. I have a Jewish prime minister in the state of Ukraine who is fighting the Soviet Union, who is not religious but is proud to be identified as a Jew. He doesn't hide it. He identifies himself as a Jew. He tells Israel, I'm disappointed, you're not supporting me. Now, he doesn't realize maybe certain things. You have a situation where you have Bennett, the Prime Minister of Israel, a religious Prime Minister of the State of Israel. Okay, he's never had a religious Prime Minister of the State of Israel. And this religious Prime Minister of the State of Israel flew on Shabbat to go meet with Putin, the biggest Gog and Magog person in the world, to mediate. Suddenly Israel is a power. Okay, we're not there yet completely. We've made much more than simply toddling baby steps, that's all. So I'm saying, you can't say that nothing happened, but when Rav Kook dies in 1935, a lot of stuff is not done. And Rav Kook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, during the war, Second World War, was picking up pieces, and after the war, I think it was a very down time for the ideology of Rav Kook. It only happens really maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years later afterwards, maybe the 50s, where Rav Kook's ideology comes back for a renaissance. Anyways, here we go. Hachol im kol tefar tomo for semet. This is a very difficult sentence to translate correctly. Hachol im kol tefar tomo for semet lo tamalei hanefesh mimena. The soul can't be satisfied. The soul can't be filled with all of this chol, all of this profane, all of this secularism. Even if it has a lot of teferis, even if it has a lot of glory. The true inner meaning of feeling that we have can't be happy completely if all you got is a secular state. Our secular group. Eino erech shlo nishlam. The value, the importance can't be completed. Kiim kishiyofia or kadosh ha'yon aleha. Only when we'll have the holy light. The holy light will shine over it, the land of Israel itself. As long as we don't have the holiness of running everything, in other words, Shabbat and kosher, and we're following the laws and everything, as long as that's there, we're still in the corridor. We're still in the front corridor, the front entranceway. In other words, you can't really say that we made complete progress. We made some progress. Okay? Okay.
What's interesting with that sentence is that it's not that he's ruling out the whole life.
Correct.
Like the life of chol. It's just that the kedusha of Eretz Yisrael will add to it.
Yeah. In other words, he's not ruling it out. He's just saying it's only the first step.
Yeah.
Right, that's the key to Rav Kook. I mean, people often say Rav Kook, oh, he went out to the non-religious kibbutzim, he believed in them, he hugged them, he talked to them. Yes and no. As a matter of fact, I have actually a tape I wanted to play during RCM. I didn't play it. I should actually play it to you. Rav Soloveitchik tells a very fascinating story. He talks about when he traveled to Eretz Yisrael in 1935. I have to play it to you. It's a 5-minute tape. He talks about visiting a non-religious kibbutz and how they met Rav Kook. Rav Kook is saying that these people are important, but they're only the first step. It's like saying, you know, I can play chess, but there's no way that I can compete against a grandmaster. I'll be off the board in three moves, right? In other words, before I blink, my king will be gone off the thing. But I know how to play chess. The answer is I'm just a neophyte. I have no clue really how to play chess. I can't play like the masters. And I can't understand Eretz Yisrael unless I understand the Kedusha that's within every individual person and within the soul of Israel in general itself. That's the key to Rav Kook. Okay, let's go back here. So every strength, the strength of all of life, or the vigor of life, finds its basis, its really strong basis, only where Rak Oide Or HaKodesh, only the holy light, She Palesh B'chaim Halomim V'chom Avraham, that's going to really come through by the national life in Israel and all of its avodah, all of its work, all of its deeds. The real power, the real vigor of life is going to happen when we get the Kedusha going. L'shem kach, anu tzrichim labeid et hagdara ha-brua. Therefore, we got to really work out a clear definition. What is mahu tochen ha-kodesh? What is the content of holiness? What does this mean? U'mahu tochen chol? What is the content of secular? Because the truth is, these are very difficult terms to make any sense of them. What's holy mean? What does holy mean? What does it mean? I mean, we're just using words here. But, right? This is one of the foundations of our work, our national work here, to define what is Kedusha, to make sure that we include it in the development of the land, to understand what is not Kedusha, so we make sure that we just don't only do the whole, right? And it's what he calls Zman Groma. That's a term that's used to deal with mitzvot. The mitzvot is bound by time. That we're bound by time. We got to get this done. We just can't sit on our tails. There's a time element to make sure that we start pushing the religious values here within building the country itself. That's what he's trying to say. This, of course, is catalyst to making his party or his group called Degen Yerushalayim. Hatchia Shleimat Chadesh Lanu L'nei Kol Chai. The final, the whole and complete of rebirth, I mean renaissance, will kind of come unfold, the Chadesh will be renewed in the eyes of everybody. Everybody's going to see this take place. What's it going to be? It's be Ha'aram Le'a. Once again, this is poetry. You've got to really take it as such. Ha'aram means light. Le'a, the complete light. Hod v'hadrat kodesh b'tfila, the whole full illumination that you find in prayer and in the Torah, b'darchei ha-musar, in the books of Musar, ethics, v'hashkafat ha-munah, in the belief system. All of this, b'chol ha-kafar ha-yoniv ha-masi, in all of its conceptual and practical, real kind of scope. All of this, whether it's b'chayei ha-yachid b'chayetzi, whether the individual life or the life of the whole community itself. In other words, the whole development has to include this spiritual themes of Torah, themes of Musar, themes of Amunah, has to be there. HaTorah tachtor b'levavot shehei nesuot l'masan nefesh ruchoni kulo. The renewal, the rebirth, is going to go down to the hearts that are really given to understand, to join in the soul, who's Ruchani, the holy soul kulo, the Tikvat Kedushat Shmamiyit, give a rebirth, to raise up the holiness of from the heavens, the spiritual holiness from the heavens. Hashem mitoch merchel kam mi'olam v'yoshvei enam mitmazgim im achayim ha-ragilim. This is so far up in the heavens that you can't even understand what it is. These hopes for spiritual visions, for development, are distant from any this world and its inhabitants. They don't mix with regular life. Shehein muchrochot liot chiyah shlima. We have to have it if we want to make a complete renaissance. So in other words, you've got to include all these spiritual lofty concepts, not concepts, life values of spirituality, which is up in the heavens. You can't even understand them in a three-dimensional world. But it's got to be part of our rebuilding the society, the land of Israel itself. Because why? Because it has to be there if you want to make a complete renaissance. You want to make a partial renaissance, a partial rebirth, you can just build the land up, make chiloni kibbutzim, secular kibbutzim. But you really want to get to the whole, the main stuff, you got to really include this as well. The tchiyat ha-kodesh on the shofim. We're aspiring for the rebirth. Tchiyat. Tchiyat means rebirth. By the way, for those who don't recognize it, Tchiyat HaMeitim, right? It's called by the rebirth of the dead. So the Tchiyat, the rebirth, the holy rebirth of the land we are aspiring to are. L'ashlama shel Tchiyat HaChol anu mitzapim. We're looking, we're hoping to get the Renaissance of the Holy. We're looking forward to the completion of the secular Renaissance. We're there. We're starting the secular renaissance. We hope we're going to finish that in order that we can get to the next step, which is really the spiritual renaissance. L'arshim et or ha-chayim shel tnuat ha-tchiyah ha-lumit shelanu v'roshim ha-malei shlo. We hope we can get going with the mundane or the secular renaissance so we can get to the final full objective, which is to produce the full impact of the light, this aura that's coming from heaven in our national movement of renaissance. So in other words, yeah, I believe in this whole Zionism stuff, says Rav Kook, but you got to understand, it's only just to get going. If we didn't have the secular Zionism, we couldn't have nothing to build on. It's the first step, it's important, but it's not really the end step. And therefore, because of this, L'shem Zeh, and in the name of this, or according to this, on Hinenu Orim or Yod Tov Lamar, Hinenu Megalim. And according to this, we're going to arouse, wake up, or be even better, say, we're going to reveal at Mitzvotov Shalat Noah Yerushalmid. We're going to reveal, we're going to announce, so to speak, it's been existing. We're making a formal announcement, make everybody aware, about this movement called Noah Yerushalmid, the Jerusalem movement. V'inenu korim b'shem Yerushalayim. We're calling it by the name of Jerusalem. What are we calling? Yerushalmid et tzad hakodesh shebetchilateinu alamid. We're calling it the Banner of Jerusalem, or the group of Jerusalem. We're calling Yerushalayim. What does Jerusalem refer to? The holiness that's in our rebirth, our national rebirth. B'shem she'inenu g'shem, in the same way she'inenu korim b'shem tzion v'tzionut, in the same way the term Zion and Zionism is being used, and we're used in the 20th century, it's 1920. At that tzad hakodesh shalah, this makes you maybe a few years from 1920. This is probably about 1910. In the same way that we use the word Zionism to talk about the secular renaissance, Zionism is not necessarily a religious movement. Religious Zionism is a religious movement. So therefore, we're going to call our movement based upon the name Jerusalem, because Jerusalem signifies to me Holy Jerusalem, Kadosh, 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 Kadoshim. The temple was in Jerusalem. Jerusalem has a greater sanctity than the rest of the land of Israel. It is. The whole city has sanctity. The city, the base of Mikdash has greater sanctity. The Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum, sanctorum is even holier. This is what we're going to call it to signify the holy renaissance we need. V'imdegel Yerushalayim, and together with the banner of Yerushalayim, the banner of my movement called the Degel Yerushalayim, Narim et Neis HaKodesh, we're going to raise the banner of holiness. Neis here means a banner, the holy banner, B'tchiyat Umah, with the rebirth of the nation. La'rot le'ein kol ma'hu ha'koach ha'tzafun asher b'neshmat ha'goy sh'akol ha'hukar. We're going to make people aware and show them what power lies hidden in the soul, in the hidden soul that's in the neshama of this whole nation, which ad kolo hukar, which was not recognized until now. The soul's been there. It's been unfound. We're going to show everybody that there's something unique about going back to Israel that is super holy. Laharot et oz Hashem. We're going to show the power of Hashem, Eros HaKodesh, the power of Hashem, the vigor of holiness, L'achyot et umah b'chol muvanah, to rebuild the nation in all of its meaning of what rebuilding is all about, in all of its meanings. L'achyot et achol b'tichat HaKodesh, to revive, to create renaissance of the secular in the renaissance of the holy. The secular has got to be there together with the holy with the secular. L'achyot et kodesh b'tgalut mifalav b'chayim, to revive and bring back to life the holiness in the revelation of everything's being done in life, b'maseh, in action, b'regesh, in feelings, in emotions, b'rayon, in thinking, b'chol ha'ekev shel ha'chayim olim sholem. Everything we're doing in life has got to be done with this feeling of recognition that the secular also has to include the holiness itself. Good, we can finish this piece. T'chiyatenu ha'lumit, our cultural, our national rebirth is going to happen. Takum l'tchiyat am gemurah. It's going to be a total revival of the people. It means all the people will come back. Right, it's going to go back to the extent, and it's going to include everything in our people, secular, society, religion, so forth. Bioto amida shehara lo kitet galaba. The same way that God revealed His divine illumination to us, to the extent that everything, when God revealed His Torah to the Jewish people, God revealed Himself in Sinai. Bioto erach shafila chumid, with these physical darkness, which was reduced the soul, reduced life, is not really going to actually going to push us down, will not control who we are. And together with this strong wind, a strong, I guess, what would you call it? Spirit is a good term. With a strong spirit, we're going to actually lift up our hearts, to realize and recognize the actions of Hashem, Asher Hu Oseh Imamo, which He does with His people, V'Aydemo, and through His people. So now you got to recognize, building Israel is not simply the power of the Zionist leadership, it's about the power of Hashem. We have an opportunity that God is giving to us now, in the beginning of the 20th century, to go and to recognize what God gave to us, which means we got to follow God's rules. Yeshuva L'Tchiyato Sh'al Mata Kodesh, going to return to relive on our holy land in Yitzurav Kulam with our Creator, with the Creator who created everything. Hakarabi Rahabi Rahazot, this clear bright recognition, the chol sidrei chayim and the whole way of life, hamasim practical and ruchanim and spiritual hayotz that come from it, v'hi yisoda shel tchiyat ha'umah. This is the basis of the creation revival of the nation, v'hamerkaz hamavaseit et binyan ha'aretz v'am, that the basis of the central basis of building the land and its people. It's got to be there. So I'm calling my movement Banner Yerushalayim, Dagel Yerushalayim to underscore this, and it's got to be there. The secular is great. Okay, good. We can just, if all finishes off here with a pasuk. Pasuk comes from Yeshayo, Perek Nun Aleph. V'yasim Dvarai Beficha, says Yeshayo. I'm going to put my word in your mouth. With Tzel Yadai Kisisicha, with the shadow of my hand, I'm going to cover you. That's what Hashem is saying to Yeshayo. This is Yeshayo 51. It's talking about future time. We first have this in Yeshayo. It's about destruction and bad kinds of prophecies, negative prophecies of evil that are coming. The end of Sefer of Yeshayo, it talks about all kinds of good stuff coming in the end of time. So God says, I'm going to put my word in your mouth. I'm not going to say it, says Hashem. You're going to say my name. And I'm going to put my shadow, my hand is going to cover you. You're going to recognize I'm pushing you along. Lintoa shamayim v'lisal aretz, in order to plant heavens, to establish earth. You're going to do it, God says. You're going to be my emissary. V'loma l'tzion amiata. You're going to say to Zion, you are my people. So that's what Pasuk ends up with, Rav Kook ends up with there. So the building of the country itself has got to include both the secular and as well as in order for the complete building has to include as well the spiritual, the Kodesh as well. That is the opening salvo. That's a great introduction. Once you understand that this is what Rav Kook is all about, you'll begin to understand everything else from Rav Kook. Not everything else, of course. But you understand why this was put here, because it sets the stage for everything Rav Kook is going to write. You're important to be in Israel, and Israel is this, and build the land, and what they're doing is great. But you know what? They got to keep going. Got to keep beyond it. Hopefully, says Rav Kook, I'll get them all to keep Shabbos. Hopefully, I'll get them all to keep kosher. And he did. He used to go visit the kibbutzim. He would talk about Shabbat. He would go for Shabbat. He would eat his own food because he couldn't eat with the kibbutzim people. And he would get them to agree to kind of kosher their kitchen. He made little headways at one point. The chain, of course, didn't become a religious country. It didn't become a religious country, except maybe Bnei Brak and Mea Sharim and parts of Yerushalayim. It's a secular country, but there is a sense of holiness that Rav Kook says has got to be there that we have to develop. There you go. That's pretty much the first piece itself.
Thank you for naturally switching Tria to reboot, rebirth, or revival. I saw you did that throughout. I don't like the translation of Renaissance.
So I don't like the word either. Tria to Mason. What's Tria to Mason means? Tchad me comes from chai, from life. It means a rebirth. The resurrection, we use the term resurrection of the dead. Resurrection doesn't mean anything here. Resurrection means you're dead, you come back alive. It means he's rebirth.
Revival is a better.
Rebirth, okay? Just in general, B'tzal and Naor's translation is a very good translation. Rav Kook is hard to read on a good day in English, a language you understand.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
I'm thinking to myself as you're reading this, I'm thinking, look who he's speaking to, guys like us, right? About Chubas, etc. We get it. But what about everybody else? I'm thinking as a nation, like so many of our nation, they're so put out, right? So education to the children is so important, unless you have guys like me who at a certain age get it in life and follow it. So how do we...
So let me give you the answer. The short answer is, your premise that you gave is not completely correct. Rav Kook wrote this book for a lot of people. First, he wrote for people who thought like he thought. He also wrote it for people who did not believe in the religious concept. He wanted them to understand the religious, spiritual values important. But he wrote it for a different group as well, and that was the religious right, who believed in the religious values but didn't understand the importance of how the religious values are going to be built into land, who rejected Zionism, who didn't see any value, who corralled the wagons around and said, we're going to build the old yeshuv and keep what we're doing in Mea Shorim or wherever the Mea Shorim was ready to do, in the old city or these other communities that settled up. And we're not really interested in going out to the fields. We're just going to do what we always did for centuries, sit and learn and study Torah. And people send us donations from Chutz Laretz, and that's how we got by. So that was the other people he wrote to. Now, you want to know something? The different communities that received his message reacted in different ways. The people on the left, they listened to Rav Kook. They tolerated him. Sometimes they listened, sometimes they didn't. The people on the right sometimes responded very negatively. got into a lot of fights for this. He got into a lot of disagreement because people said, who are you doing reaching out to these people? Anyways, the time is up. I know we're past 12 o'clock. It's a good introduction, a good way to get into it. Your feet are a little bit wet. You're still on the diving board. You haven't really jumped off yet. You're in the shallow water. You're off the diving board, but you're in the shallow water. Anyways, next time we actually get into Sefer El Road itself, the first couple of pieces are easy. It's good. But you all know about Eretz Yisrael. No one has to tell you about that. But you'll see it's going to develop and really be, it's really a great book. It's a terrific book. It's an exciting book. I'm really pumped to do it. Anyways, have a wonderful day, guys. Okay, what's tomorrow? Thursday?
Yes. I don't know if I'll be around the next 3 weeks.
Let me just say goodbye to people, okay? Goodbye, Sammy. Goodbye, Rafael. Goodbye, Avram. Goodbye, Jeff. Goodbye, Yochanan. Right. Yes, Shelly.
We're leaving for Israel Sunday, God willing, right. So I'll be away for about 3 weeks. I don't know how much I'll be able to join in. We're also going to Dubai for a week, so the time difference.
Wow, good for you.
Anyways, but it's a good time to prepare for the trip.
Right.
Thank you.
Anyways, I'm going to try to tape it, just the audio, okay?
Perfect.
So if I remember to do so, then I'll be able to store it, and I can send it down to you sometime when you have an opportunity, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes, sir. Yes, Avram. Okay, see you, Shelley. Have a good trip. Yes.
I don't know if I understand the Zionism the way because the Bible full of Zion, and I don't understand how it all of a sudden becomes secular.
So, what happens is over the course of time, Jews are the temple is destroyed. The Jews are outside of Israel. That goes on for about 2,000 years, correct?
Yeah.
In the course of those 2,000 years, somewhere around the 18th century, with the Renaissance and with the Reformation, a lot of other things, secularism creeps into everything in life. It creeps into the Christian society, it creeps into Jewish society. So you find that the secular values have more of a push. In the 1800s, when all different groups of people are beginning to find their own national voice, and they're beginning to rise up against the major empires of the world, the French Empire, the English Empire, the Spanish Empire, and you've got all these different countries that are breaking away from their commonwealths, so I guess you'd call it, or empires. So the Jews do it as well. The secular group of Zionists were very happy to do the same thing, push their identity as a secular group of Jews, secular values and the secular identity of who the Jews were. That's why some of them would have gone to Uganda, because Israel was not that important. Even those who wanted to go to Israel did it really on secular terms. We want to escape from the ghettos of Europe, the persecutions of Europe. We want to go to Israel, build a free country. We're going to build it with our own hands. We're going to make the farms. We're going to make the kibbutzim. But you know what? It's not about Jewish Judaism. It's about being a Jewish people who are free. That's what secular Zionism is all about. You can be a religious Zionist, and you combine both religious values and Zionism. What Rav Kook is saying is that you have to be a religious Zionist.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
But Rav Kook says,
I don't know why a secular use the word Zion because it's so biblical.
Well,
that's what I don't understand.
So the answer is there are people who built the land who did not believe in religion. That's what secular Zionism means. Jews who are Jewish, who did not practice Judaism, who did not keep the faith, who kept secular values, who were just very happy to be French citizens or English citizens, but now they're going to build their own country and we're going to call it Zionism, because it's built in Israel. But they did not keep Shabbat, they did not keep kosher, they didn't keep Yom Kippur, etc., etc. They had one kitchen for milk, for fleishik, for meat and dairy. They had non-kosher food. They didn't keep Shabbat, was a working day in the field. That's what I mean, okay?
So there's religious Zionists and there's secular Zionists.
Right, correct. That's pretty much it, yes.
Okay. Sorry.
No problem, not sorry. Happy to take time with you.
Well, it was confusing.
Okay, there you go. Okay, have a great day, Avram. It's good to always have you with us.
There was a Lutheran church in Waterloo called Mount Zion.
There was a church?
In Waterloo.
Yeah.
Mount Zion.
Okay, So in Christian, okay. So
it just speaks to me of religiosity. That
right. I see now. I see. Okay. So yes, that's.
That she was a secular person.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Good. I think you got it now. Good. Okay. Have a wonderful day. Good.